Because the book has a pink cover, this simply must mean that the only people who can read it are young women. And if we are to judge the books with pink covers as feminine only, we must also categorize the Bibles found in hotel room drawers as only for fundamentalist agoraphobics, books that feature the back of a person's head as a suitable read only for the socially maladjusted, and the books in paperback as titles solely for cheap bastards. Jim Crow worked wonderfully for humanity, and it works even better for the publishing industry.
Okay, so I am once again here with the delightful and lovely Jennifer Weiner, who is most recently the author of Certain Girls, and I'm trying to keep my voice relatively quiet because I understand there's a baby in the background. But Jen, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Baby's sleeping, and life is really good.
Okay, good. Well, I wanted to, first of all, we didn't get a chance to really discuss Good in Bed last time.
And you've been miserable ever since,
haven't you? I have gone to bed crying in tears. I have chatted with guy friends of mine, having those kind of girly chats that we usually have. Mm-hmm. But now we can kind of rectify this, and I don't have to be an emotional bundle. But I wanted to ask you and start with some comparisons between the two books.
Mm-hmm.
In the first book, you have Cannie reacting to Bruce's column in the Maxim-like Moxie magazine.
Yes, exactly.
And in this, you have Joy reacting to Cannie's book, her thinly disguised novel, that bears certain similarities to Good in Bed.
It's a hall of mirrors.
Yes.
It's a reflection of a reflection of a drawing of a rendering of a... No, I'm interested in, I guess, how you quantify the past and sort of what becomes your history. And so here's Cannie and Bruce in Good in Bed. They've gone through this breakup, and Cannie sort of picked herself up and dusted herself off, and she's moving forward. And she thinks that she's sort of defined what happened in that relationship in her head. And then she reads this article in this magazine called Loving a Larger Woman. And of course, she's mortified, and everybody's going to know that's her. But it's this sort of... It's Bruce's take on the relationship and on what wasn't working for him, which sort of throws her in a tailspin because it's very different than her ideas of what had happened with the two of them. And I'm really interested in going back to that idea in Certain Girls, where now we have a mother and a daughter instead of a guy and a girl. And it's Joy, Cannie's daughter, who's 12, going on 13, going on 30, finding her mother's book and recognizing a version of her own history that doesn't square with what she's been told and what she believes. And it's an idea of, I'm going to construct memory almost. I mean, here's this text that says one thing. Here's my beliefs that say something else. And I think you can look at both books as sort of women rebuilding their histories, sort of answering the big questions, who am I, what happened to me, and who am I going forward?
Well, I wanted to ask you about the idea of having text as a responsive medium. I mean, in both cases, that's what's happening here.
Uh-huh.
And we were sort of alluding to this metafictional quality, which is even more pronounced in this because Cannie takes on certain similarities. In fact, it could sufficiently be argued that Cannie is perhaps the closest to you of all of your characters. And so
I
want to ask you about this. Is responding to text or responding in general kind of the best way for you to drive a narrative along like this?
Well, I mean, some of it's driving a narrative and some of it is just like, there are things I want to say, God damn it. And I don't write for newspapers anymore.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that like there's a critique in Certain Girls of chick lit and of the way chick lit is responded to in the culture that I've wanted to say for the longest time. And, you know, but it's like nobody's going to let me write an op-ed about it. Or maybe they would. I didn't really try. But, I think that there's – I like the idea of responding to text and the idea of there's a story out there driving the story that I'm writing.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you, I mean, in both books feature characters. Cannie in the first one is pretty much essentially espousing all of her neuroses. And essentially the book is this manner for all the side characters and the supporting characters to kind of put up with her, but also she's the sounding board for all these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Joy start to take on these very similar characteristics, and in fact, there are a lot of close similarities.
Well, they are related.
Yeah, they are related.
I think that daughters, as much as Joy is embarrassed by her mother, wants to distance herself from her mother, wants to be totally different from her mother, I think we all wind up being our mother's daughters in one way or another. And I think that that's what's happened.
Yeah. And yet, Cannie is considerably more conservative in this book.
Oh, my God. She has done everything but, like, put on a burqa. Because yeah. I think that she recognized in a really vivid and visceral way the idea that exposing herself has also exposed her family. Mm-hmm. And that horrifies her. I mean, because I think, you know, and this is something that I sort of wrestled with on a much lesser level, but the idea that, like, you can be this writer, you're the single girl, you're putting it all out there, you're, you know, blogging and you're writing and you're doing whatever. And then the idea that it's going to come back and bite you in the ass is something that I think most of us as grownups can deal with, that not everybody's going to agree with everything you say. But the idea that it's going to sort of rebound onto your family and rebound onto your kids is something that's incredibly difficult for Cannie to deal with. Yes. And she feels that that her daughter has really been placed in danger because of what she's done and what she said. And so she's retrenched in this really dramatic way where she's, you know, I think the image that I come back to is that she's had the special 5-point racing car harness installed in her minivan. Yeah. So her daughter can be, like, super, super safe.
She's threatened, for example, by Greece. But I wanted to bring this up for a very specific reason, because in our last conversation, we were discussing the going to the mat for bluntness mm-hmm. in Goodnight Nobody. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me very interesting that you made Cannie a little bit more conservative and a little bit more troubled by mm-hmm. Greece, for crying out loud.
I know.
While likewise also making Joy, well, mm-hmm. she can go so far mm-hmm. because she's a teenager, and she does. I mean, there's a financial episode later in the book, which I won't reveal, but mm-hmm. there's also passing the schnapps around in synagogue.
Yeah. So rabbi is going to read that, and I'm going to be in so much trouble.
Well, the point in mentioning all this is I'm wondering if, given the limitations and the fights that you had in Goodnight Nobody, whether you mm-hmm. kind of set limits here because, well, there's only perhaps so far that you can go as a writer into being as blunt like this, or...
Nah, you know, I think that it made sense for me for Cannie to have pulled back the way she did, because I think that that's, like, a very realistic response that a writer could have, that a woman writer could have, that a mother could have, to sort of realize that, like, you've exposed yourself, okay, you've exposed your family, maybe not so okay, and she's done sort of like a super, super radical version of, you know, instead of, like, taking a step back or even a giant step back, she's essentially, like, moved into a cave. And I've talked about this book in other ways as sort of a coming-of-age story. For Joy, obviously, because it's about her bat mitzvah, which is, you know, the Jewish ceremony, you become an adult. But it's a coming-of-age story for Cannie also, where she writes this book. Things happen as a result of writing this book. Things happen with Bruce. Things happen with Cannie's own father. And she says, never again. I'm not doing this. I'm not putting myself out there. I'm not putting myself through it. I'm not putting the people I love through it. I'm going to write science fiction under a fake name, which I had so much fun doing. We'll get to that maybe. But in early drafts of the book, there was a lot more of sort of the fake Lila Dare story. But I think that it's me as a writer exploring one of the ways it could have gone. Like, if you get burned, if you get slammed, if you get ignored, if there's just a point where you say, like, enough of this. Like, you know, I'm just going to, like, grow my garden and make my soup and raise my kids. And who needs this? Mm. It hasn't been a choice I've made yet, but it was interesting to sort of, like, think about.
I mean, I ask about the effusiveness because it's here in spurts. Like, you have Sam being involved with this J-date, like, site.
Right. A Jew for You.com.
Yeah, exactly. And I found that to be quite funny. Uh-huh. But I got a sense in some instances that kind of roping yourself into these limitations was a kind of way to avoid these more blunter forms that have been throughout your work. And that's why I asked this question.
I didn't think that's what was going on, but maybe. I mean, you know, I didn't feel constrained in any way, but I was writing about a character who did. So maybe that's the problem.
Huh. I mean, I'm wondering, because, I mean, you have a certain kind of audience and a certain amount of sales. And so this is why I asked the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is by no means taking away from what's in this particular book. Mm-hmm. But I also happen to think that you do excel with a lot of these blunt uh-huh. sort of approaches.
Earthy. Yeah, but no, I mean, if you're asking, like, you know, if my editors tried to, like, steer the ship a certain way, like, no, it doesn't happen. Like, this was, you know, this was the book that I wanted to write, and these were the things I wanted to say. And somebody interviewed me and they said, you know, this just isn't as chick-litty as some of your other stuff. And did you try to make it less chick-litty? Like, are you trying to like appeal to grown-ups now or something like that? And I never set out to sort of write a chick-lit book or a less chick-lit book or a more constrained book or a more effusive book. I mean, I just sort of want to tell the story that I'm telling at that particular moment and do it as well as I can. So, like, there's nobody sort of telling me if that's what you're worried about.
Well, I am worried about, because, I mean, you are writing a sequel to the book that launched your career, uh-huh. that many people consider, well, this is the definitive Jen Weiner book. And uh-huh. that's why I say, I mean, if I were in your shoes, uh-huh, so to speak. I would probably be thinking about, oh, well, I have a certain kind of obligation to my audience in uh-huh. the sense that I have to present similarities. And I guess, given the bluntness in Good Night Nobody, that's why I asked this question.
Sequels are always tricky. They always are, because at least for me, I didn't want to write Good in Bed 6 weeks later, yeah. like Better in Bed kind of thing. I wanted to write about the same characters, but have them change, you know, like have them go someplace and have them be dealing with different issues than they were in the first book. And that's why we did the time thing. That's why it's sort of 12 years later and Cannie's in a different place. And Joy is obviously in a different place because she was an infant in Good in Bed. You know, I'm always interested in sort of trying new things as a writer. And, you know, it is risky because I think that there are, you know, you were talking about my audience and my fan base. I mean, I'm sure there are people who don't want anything except Good in Bed, Good in Bed, Good in Bed, yeah. you know. And anytime you change it up, you risk disappointing people, which, you know, is a hard thing if you're like me and you're the oldest child and you never want to disappoint anybody. But I liked writing this book because it pushed me in different ways, you know, to sort of write about a character who is scared, you know, as Cannie is, and then to write about a character who is furious as Joy is in certain cases. So
by making Cannie 42, uh-huh. I mean, essentially you are setting this thing in the future. Mm-hmm. It's 2012 or thereabouts.
2013.
Yeah,
we did the math.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm wondering about this because it's almost as if we are to go back to this idea that Cannie represents Jen here, uh-huh, uh-huh. then we...
Oh, man,
it's almost as if,
I'm so screwed.
It's almost as if you've set out to answer your own worst nightmare in terms of you being a parent mm-hmm. and you having to deal with kids growing up to do crazy sorts
of
things.
That's absolutely true. I mean, this book, one of the places it came from was sort of the idea that my kids are going to read my book someday. Like, maybe. I mean, I write about this in Certain Girls, but I take great, great, great comfort in this interview I read with Erica Jong, where she was asked, like, did Molly, your daughter, ever read Fear of Flying? And she said, yeah, you know, she picked it up. I think she read like 50 pages. And then she was like, yeah, this isn't for me. And I'm like, okay, that's what's going to happen. They're going to find Good in Bed, and I'm just not going to make a big deal. And they'll pick it up and read it and be like, nah, you know, and that'll be the end of the conversation. Yeah. I do not think I will be getting as lucky as Erica Jong did, because I think that, I don't know, I worry a lot about the idea of, like, are my kids going to be scandalized by the idea that, like, there was this book with, like, naked legs and cheesecake on the cover and there's sex in it and there's blowjobs in it and oh my God kind of thing. But I don't know. You know, the joke I tell now is that if I had written that book as a married woman with kids, I would not have called it Good in Bed. I would have called it Don't Read This Very Boring Dry Book. I don't think it would have done real well in bookstores,
yeah,
but that's the direction.
I mean, going to the science fiction component, I mean, I'd be happy to dig up mm-hmm. once again Jezebel Bright, because mm-hmm. this is the novel you've had sitting in a drawer.
And
it's aging. You have, of course, Cannie writing science fiction uh-huh. names under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost as if I almost want to propose to you. I mean, mm-hmm. now that superhero novels are really big.
You know, I wrote a short story for Owen King's anthology that's yeah. coming out this summer.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I loved it. I had a really good time. It's a woman in Philadelphia who has gone through a divorce from a very big deal literary male novelist. Mm-hmm. And they met at an MFA program, and he was the star and she was sort of the helpmeet, and he gets this big publishing deal and she can't live with it. And they break up. She moves to Philadelphia and starts getting emails from dead people.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, defying expectations like this, I mean, it's almost as if, you've reached a level of success in your career that you could, in fact, I would even encourage you to pursue Jezebel Bright again, because I think the world could really use something like this. I think your fan base could use this, because there's also a lot of geeky components in this book. I'll get into that later, but
yeah.
But I mean, you know, I mean, I kept reading this, and there's a pleasant geeky quality about this.
Thank you. You've got the whole pleasantly geeky. I love it.
No, of course. But I mean, the thing is going back to what you were describing earlier about the notion of like, oh, well, this seems less chick-litty, as other people have said. I mean, you've got Sam doing the Photoshop thing. Mm-hmm. You take a great deal of joy, actually going and using Wikipedia and hacking the parental controls on her computer.
Right.
A number of things. I mean, I've got a whole laundry list. Oh, and of course, Bruce becoming an expert in semiotics in Battlestar Galactica and Doctor Who. So this would seem to me that,
little shout-outs.
Yeah, it's more than shout-outs. It's almost as if here is Jen Weiner the geek. I was reading this going, well, why don't we get more of this? I mean,
I might have to go back to Jezebel Bright. I mean, I did want to sort of locate the book and the characters in it in this sort of culture that, like, you know, reads science fiction and watches Battlestar Galactica and thinks about these things on sort of a serious level, or at least as serious entertainment. So yeah, you know, maybe I am secretly thinking about that book again. 500 pages, man. It's a big old mess right now, but it's interesting. It's an interesting mess. So.
Well, the thing is, too, also the preoccupation with media culture. You alluded earlier in this conversation to, well, you're not a journalist, so you need to find a form to respond to things around us. In fact, media culture forms the linchpin for both of the books as well. In the first book, we see a rather austere publicist, and in this book, we see a gawker-like site known as Gawkit.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially,
Grokket.
I'm so sorry. so it goes. That actually reveals Canny's secret identity.
Secret identity. And of course, you know, the fans are not pleased to learn that that Lila Dare's adventures are being written by somebody who wrote one of those pink books. Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, I think that there is a lot of me sort of working through the idea of exposure and sort of how do people react if X or if Y or if Z, you know, and I wonder how people would react if I sort of served them up something that was just a complete zag instead of a zig kind of thing where there weren't sort of, I mean, I think my voice is always going to be my voice. Like, you can't do much about that. Yeah. I think that my books are always going to sound a certain way. They're always going to have certain sort of themes and certain ideas. But if it was something that was sort of, you know, more of a fantasy, I wonder, I don't know. Would people come with me? I mean, how's Anne Rice doing with the Jesus thing?
Yeah.
How's that working out?
But I don't think you would have something as schlocky as Jesus or something, you know?
You're calling Jesus names now?
Yeah, well, no, I'm talking about I read an excerpt of that book and I was, oh my God. But I mean, seriously,
what
though.
What happened to her? Can we talk about this? Like, did she fall on her head? And it was like...
Who knows?
I mean...
But the question... You're evading the question here. And I have to get you...
Damn it.
Very, very nice try there. Yeah. But I mean, to what degree can you really care about reader expectations? Because particularly with this geek...
Yeah, you know...
Friendly thing.
You don't want to disappoint people. Or I don't want to disappoint people. I mean, I think that maybe it's being an oldest child thing. Or it's like... I always like tie myself up in knots around review time with publications that give grades, because I always got really good grades in school. And the idea that I'm not going to get a good grade is like hard for me to deal with. I mean, I was in college, I was the person who turned her senior thesis in early, which is like sickening to think about now. But it would be hard, I think, if readers sort of felt like they were going to my books for something and not finding it. So I think I'd have to give them enough of what they wanted while sort of doing enough of what I wanted.
Yeah. But I mean, to a certain degree, I mean, we were talking about your voice not changing that much. Mm-hmm. No matter what you write, indisputably, it's going to be a Jennifer Weiner book.
That's true.
And
that's
so, true. I mean, and not only that, but there are also the larger thematics, I think, in your work.
Right.
I mean, in both of these books, you have a pregnancy happening while you're having to let go of someone. In the first case, it's the boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And in the second case, it's the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And this, to me, is likewise intriguing. I mean, likewise, the poetry that is frequently throughout your books. And so I'm saying that there's some stuff in here that I'm wondering wondering if why not push this further, or you know, it's almost innately part of the Jennifer Weiner book.
And no one notices it. It's interesting.
I do.
Well, thank you. You're rare. You're a rare reader, because for most people, it's like, yay, shoe shopping. And I love shoe shopping. There's nothing wrong with it. But I always like when people sort of get those little sort of coded things that sneak in there, you know.
Well, I mean,
I was a closet Trekkie.
Yeah.
You know? We can talk about that.
Yeah, but we can talk about that.
I'm in a support group.
I mean, like, let's say you were to write a chick lit book in which mm-hmm. it was, or rather just a novel. Let's just do away with this really ridiculous term, because quite mm-hmm. frankly, if we were to apply David Copperfield to the same standards, it would be a chick lit book because it ends up happy, you
yes.
know. So,
yes.
So let's just go ahead and do away with that. And let's just talk about, like, you writing hypothetically. Like a closet trackie
uh-huh.
who finds love or something uh-huh. or you know, or even Jezebel Brett, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, it could happen. I mean, I never really know what my next book's gonna be until it just kinda comes. So there's two things I'm playing with now. One is nonfiction and one is fiction. And the fiction one has some really dark, dark, dark stuff going on. And I'm not really sure how the whole science fiction part of the puzzle fits into it, but I don't know if it's going to be Jezebel Bright, or if Jezebel Bright becomes like the book within that book almost, the way it kind of did a little bit with Certain Girls and Lila Dare and the Star Girl stuff. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
I have to wait for my muse to get in touch.
Oh, fair enough.
Check my BlackBerry.
There were 42 chapters in this book,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to ask you about that. And I also wanted to ask you about the fact that this book is written in three parts,
mm-hmm.
which would connote a three-act Hollywood screenplay, whereas
mm-hmm.
Good in Bed
mm-hmm.
is in five parts, which would mm-hmm. seem to connote a Greek tragedy.
Or yeah.
Your Cymbeline, so to speak.
Yes, yes, that's always...
Sorry to compare you to Shakespeare.
That's always how I think of it. No, I mean, I think maybe I was thinking about trimesters.
Ah, yeah.
You know, I think that because there's the idea of the pregnancy and the baby that Cannie wants to have but can't have sort of in the normal way is very much on her mind, sort of having one child and letting go of another one. So, and also I was pregnant by the time I was sort of on the second or third draft of this book. So I think trimesters was maybe what I was thinking of, you know. And 42... that's close to the weeks of a pregnancy, 40 weeks in a pregnancy.
It's also the answer to life, the universe, and everything, if you want to acknowledge the geeky side here.
Shh. You're going
to
piss me off.
Well, no, you don't have to be silent about this. Seriously.
So it goes.
Well, I mean, we're seeing like the mainstreaming of geek, essentially. So it's not okay to be a geek. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, it's... I'm writing... Okay, you're the first person who's hearing about this, but I'm working on a TV script. I signed a deal with ABC, a development deal, where they basically want ideas. And the idea that I gave them is called Girl Genius. And it's this girl who is a genius. I know, it's you know, a big stretch. But she's one of these, like, you know, she finishes college at, like, 14 and has two PhDs and an MD and is 21 years old and wins this fellowship that's sort of a MacArthur, mm-hmm. where it's basically like, here is a honking chunk of money. You can go study whatever you want. And she decides that she's going to study sort of single girls in their environment because she wants a life. She wants to have a year. She wants a rump spring, as she keeps saying, you know, and everybody keeps saying you're not Amish, so you don't get that. But she wants to sort of... She has an older half-sister who lives in New York, and so she goes and finds her sister because, of course, I'm always doing the sister thing, too. But it's sort of, she is this incredible geek who does not even understand how geeky she is, and she's in New York sort of employing the scientific method of, you know, observation and hypothesis and figuring it out. But there's, you reminded me of that because there's this conversation that she has with two of her geeky friends where she's trying to say that, like, this is the moment of the geek. This is a geek ascendancy. Like, look at Barack Obama and look at Bill Gates, and like they got married and it all worked out, and her friends are just like, it's like high school out there, only with bigger halls and better food.
Have you ever written anything under a pseudonym?
No comment.
Ah, we're gonna have to leave the real Gawker to sort of unearth this, I suspect. You can neither confirm nor deny.
I'm just gonna say no comment.
Okay, well, we're gonna have to dig things up.
Mm-hmm.
Has pumpkin ever been a code word for you?
That's my safe word.
Yeah. Quite literally or quite... I mean, that's one hell of a safe word. My goodness.
Pumpkin.
I mean...
my What Ed is talking about is in the book, Cannie's best friend is dating, and she has, they have this safe word where if Cannie calls Sam or if Sam calls Cannie and says pumpkin, it means something on this date has gone really badly wrong and you need to come save my ass.
Yeah.
And I do have a word like that with my best friend, even though now we're both married, we still have the word. It mostly has to do with like other things now, but pumpkin is not my safe word.
What is your safe word?
Do you even know what I'm talking about?
Hell yeah.
Sorry, my sister. Yeah. She knows what I'm talking about.
Oh, wow.
Sláinte.
Sláinte?
Sláinte.
Sorry. I was also extremely curious about the see it, be it self-help philosophy.
Oh, God, did that...
Yeah, I mean, was this based off of anything specific? I mean, it's not as overt as a lot of the other stuff.
Well, I mean, definitely The Secret was a very big book when I was writing Certain Girls. And of course, The Secret is published by my publisher. So I felt the need to be extremely, extremely politic when talking about The Secret, which sort of became See It Be It, where you visualize the thing you want and it manifests itself in the universe. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so I'm, you know, it's like the joke on 30 Rock where Jane Krasinski's character stares into the light and says, I am Mrs. George Clooney. I am Mrs. George Clooney. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely, but like there's so much self-help out there and so much of it is kind of easy to satirize.
Well, we haven't even touched upon the notion of surrogate mothers that is in this book. Mm-hmm. I found this to be interesting on a number of levels in light of we were about to allude possibly to the Caitlin Flanagan, Lori Gottlieb school of thinking. Yeah. And it seemed to be quite interesting that you dwelt upon surrogate mothers with mm-hmm. this, because while there are all these rather conservative notions of what it is to be a woman or a mother these days about how you should settle for a man or how you should immerse yourself in housekeeping, then the sort of political charge that was once with surrogate mothers has kind of taken a back seat. So I found this to be a very interesting choice on your part. And yet there still remains a good deal of struggle and conflict.
I mean, I wanted there to be like some... critique of the commodification of you know, the rent-a-womb idea. And this, you know, I was writing the book even before the whole Time story about, like, women going to India and just hiring some poor woman to, like, gestate your kid. Yeah. Not because you can't, but just because you don't want to. I mean, to me, that's like, we're in Margaret Atwood land mm-hmm. when that starts happening. The idea that you can just go hire somebody to do this, not because you're physically incapable, but because you just... don't want to have baby, you know, you don't want to stretch out your business.
You mean we're not in Margaret Atwood land?
We're there. we're there. But that was sort of like I wrote my thesis in college about representations of maternity in women's novels and women's films. And I'm always interested in sort of the narrative of maternity and the idea of like essentialism versus construction and what makes a mother. Mm-hmm. And can a kid that somebody else carries truly be yours? You know, like what makes it yours? So, you know, ideas that sort of come up over and over in my stuff.
I also wanted to ask you about Peter in both books.
Yes.
This man is more understanding than any man I've ever met. I mean, in light of the neuroses.
That's why. I think that there's always an element of wish fulfillment in my books where it's like, you know, something wonderful happens, something like sort of extraordinarily wonderful. And I think that Peter is extraordinarily wonderful and puts up with Cannie's nonsense in a way that would be difficult for many men to do. But I don't want to give away the ending, but something happens to Peter, and my mom read the book and called me like really indignant, like angrier than I've ever heard her about anything I've written. And she's like, "Why did you do this?" And I'm like, "Ma, he's just too good.
Yeah.
You know, like something has to happen."
Well, the thing is that in light of the early goal, the early idea, he asks Cannie, he gives her a very specific request, and then you have this ending. Mm-hmm. So it's almost as if, wow, I was struck by the notion of here's a guy who
you get what you
only
want,
has
you pay.
One, he has one simple request. You know, he puts up with everything, and then this ending happens, and it's like, good Lord.
I mean, you know what the moral is? Don't ask for anything.
Well, the moral here is that you this, here's a guy who's understanding too much. I mean, this is what happens
this is
when
what
this
happens.
Happens.
Be careful.
Yeah, I mean,
because Lori Gottlieb's out there looking for you.
No, but I mean, but this was very interesting to me because it suggests a, even though Canny emerges at the end with a completely different perspective, it still nevertheless is interesting in light of how she relates to the, this notion of family. And I wanted to ask you about, I mean, I'm trying to be as oblique as I can.
Yeah. I know it's hard. I mean, basically, I'm always sort of playing with the idea of happy endings and the idea of the happy enough ending, I guess, where I have characters who get everything they want, but it doesn't all happen at the same time or at the moment they want it. And I think that's what was going on in this book is sort of I wanted to give her as much of a happy ending as I could, given some of the other things that were happening in the story, and to sort of talk about the idea that even under imperfect circumstances, you sort of make your own happiness and go on.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, Jen, we have to go. Unfortunately, I could talk with you forever, but we'll have to do this
Laura
again.
Laura's in the lobby waiting.
But thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It was a pleasure chatting with you
Absolutely
again. We'll talk again, I'm sure.
Good deal.
Great. Thanks.